Hi, this is Mimi Sheraton, author of 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, and you are listening to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Carrie Diamond, editorial director of Cherry Bomb, the indie magazine about women and food. Today's show is very special because it's our 100th episode. To celebrate, we taped our program in front of a live audience at Headley & Bennett headquarters outside downtown Los Angeles. It was a fun night with more than 100 incredible guests and wonderful snacks from Chef Nina Clemente and sous chef Zena Scharf of the Smiles d'Alba, a new hotspot in the city, and Carrie Ha of Big Bar created a signature cocktail for us. Kerrygold was our sponsor for the evening, so there was a ton of wonderful cheese and Kerrygold Irish cream liqueur on the rocks and lots of butter in the snacks, except the vegan ones, of course. I was incredibly honored to interview Ruth Reichel, who we all know and love, and Chef Nancy Silverton of the Mozza Restaurant Empire. Before we get to my talk with them, we'll hear from author Stephanie Dandler, who will read a very sexy selection from her bestseller, Sweet Bitter. You will never think of oysters in the same way. And kicking things off is Headley & Bennett founder Ellen Bennett with her pep talk titled The Art of the Hustle. Ellen, by the way, entered the room via zip line. That girl sure knows how to make an entrance.
I always wanted to do that. Now, check it off the bucket list. Okay, hi guys. So, every week we have a staff meeting at our office, and we always end up, the entire meeting is finished with me giving the team a pep talk. So, I thought it fitting for tonight to give you guys a little pep talk about life. So, the words that I really, really live by and I wake up to every day is wake up and fight. And I feel like it basically means it's in you to get up, to do it, to get out there and make some stuff happen. And it consists of literally just deciding that you can do it. And every day I decide that today I'm going to do it and I'm going to make some stuff happen. So I always get up, and these days I've been going to boxing and yoga and spinning, and I don't have a lot of time because now I have all kinds of stuff and obligations I have to do, but I cram in the time and I make it happen, and I feel so much better, and we're just so lucky to be alive and to have like arms and legs and a nose and a head that work, and why miss a day of this awesome life? And you just have to really get out there and fight. So that's my first part of my pep talk. The second part that I love is if the front door isn't open, climbing through the window. What does that mean? It means don't just stop because you ran into a wall or you don't see an entrance or you don't know how to get there or you don't know somebody that knows somebody. Everything that we've done with Headley & Bennett was very much, we were just like, we're going to find a way. And if there isn't a front door, you climb in through the window. And if there isn't a window, you make a window. And if there isn't a window or a wall, you go through the back garden. And you just find a way and you get scrappy. And you have to just be okay with being scrappy. And once you're okay with being scrappy, it's kind of like all rules go to hell and you can just do it. And so just do it, okay? My other one is, I really feel that like sheer determination will get you very, very far. There's been a lot of times, I mean, I was a line cook, I'm a CEO now. I can't even tell you the meltdowns behind the scenes that happen to make stuff happen. And it takes a lot of determination and just sheer willpower to push through all those times. And you kind of have to be your own cheerleader. You have to just say, hey, you can do it, get up. Okay, cry a little bit, maybe whine, maybe punch a wall or something, but then get back up and keep going because it's in you. And I've run marathons before, and the reason I wanted to do marathons was because I was like, okay, if you can run 26 miles and not die, you could pretty much do most things in life. And if you've ever run, when you get to about mile 20, you really feel like you're going to die, or maybe you already did and your legs are still moving, and then you still keep going another 6 miles and you're like, how am I physically still on this earth right now? And then you get to the end of it and you're like, oh, you proved yourself wrong and you kind of proved yourself right. You could do it and you always could. And then you were like, okay, I am stronger than I think I am. So you really are stronger than you think you are. You just have to push through the uncomfortable, painful, awful, nasty parts. So basically, stretch your mental muscles. Don't give up. Wake up and fight. Hustle your heart out, and you can make something awesome happen. And right now, we are in the time of the woman. I mean, it's like we're here. We're doing it. And it's so exciting. And so I feel like it's our freaking duty to get out there and prove to the world that we are awesome and we are here in numbers and we bring so much heart and soul to everything that we do. So, like, let's prove it to the world. Let's fucking kill it, ladies. Okay? So thank you. Oh, and my last one. This is a good one. I can't forget this one. They aren't bumps in the road. They are the road. I mean, how true is that? There is no easy way. There is no little side access road to success. It really does look like a work suit. And then you just have to get out there and do it. I mean, it really, truly, truly, truly. So hustle, work your heart out. You're going to make it. It'll be awesome. And then we will all cheer you on too. So now I want to just pivot to our freaking awesome lady friend who's going to come up next, Stephanie Dandler. She's the author of the best-selling novel, Sweet Bitter. She's a badass. And she's so cute, and her outfit's amazing tonight. It's true. I already invited her to my house this weekend. I'm like, let's be friends. Stephanie is based in LA now, and she's joining us tonight to read from her book. Please, let's welcome her up on stage.
Tonight, well, first of all, hi, I'm Stephanie. I wrote Sweet Bitter, and it's been almost a year, and there have been a ton of crazy, beautiful moments, a lot of hectic moments, but in the car on the way over here was one of those, like, laughing to myself. I'm just going to go hang out with Ruth and Nancy, my buddies, my friends. Like, somehow I have gotten access to this room with women that I have been idolizing and admiring, it feels like, for my whole life. So I'm very honored to be here. Carrie, thank you for having me. And I'm going to read a little bit from Sweet Bitter. Oh, it's a coming-of-age story about a young woman that moves to New York City. The beginning of the book is a lot of firsts. So, like, first champagne, first line of cocaine, first friend, and we'll talk about one of those firsts tonight. The first oyster was a cold lozenge to push past, to push down, to take behind the taste buds in the back of the throat. Nobody had to tell me this. I was the oyster virgin. My fear told me what to do when the small, wet stone came into my mouth. Wellfleet, someone said. No, too small. PEI. Yeah, some cream, but so briny. Briny. PEI. A code. I took a second oyster in my hand, inspected it. The shell was sharp, sculptural, a container naturally molded to its contents like skin. The oyster flinched. I suspended it on my tongue this time. Briny means salty. It means made by the ocean. It means breathing seawater, metallic, musky, kelp. My mouth like a fishing wharf. Jake was on his third, flipping the shells over onto the ice. Swallow, now. I'm going to say West Coast. It's too creamy, someone said. But clean. Kumamoto's, Washington, right? He said. He's right, said Zoe, smiling for him like a fool. Kumamoto's, I wrote it down. I heard him say, do you like them? I thought he was talking to me, but pretended to be confused. Me? Do I like them? I had no idea. I took gulps of water. The taste stayed. In the locker room, I brushed my teeth twice, stuck my tongue out in the mirror, wondering when the residue would go away. After service, the dishwashers rolled up the sticky bar mats, and the smell of rot rose from the blackened grout in the tiles. The kitchen was a hollow amphitheater of stainless steel, still, but holding the after effects of the fires and banging and shouting. The kitchen boys were scrubbing every surface, rubbing out the night. Two servers sat on the lowboy, eating pickled red onions from a metal tin. Leftover ice cream sat on the bread station, turning to soup. Hey, new girl. I'm in here. Me? Jake was in the doorway of a walk-in. He had a cup full of lemon wedges in his hand. His apron was streaked with wine, the shirt sleeves were rolled high, and I could see his veins. Are you allowed to be in there? What I meant is, do you think about me the way I think about you? Did you like them? He asked again. The oysters. When he said the word oysters, their flavor flamed on my tongue as if it had been lying dormant. Yes, I think I do. Come in here. His tattoos showed themselves as he pressed the door open wider. I passed under his arm, looking back to make sure no one was watching. I'd never been in any space alone with him. Are we going to get locked in? What I meant is, I'm scared. Inside, there were two open beers, the Schneiderweiss Aventinus, a bottle I'd pulled for the bar but never tasted. The beers were propped against a cardboard box labeled greens but filled with little neck clams. We were in the seafood closet. Crimson tuna fillets, marbled salmon sides, snowy cod. The air nipped at my skin, smelling like the barest trace of the sea. Jake dug through a wooden crate labeled with masking tape, Kumamoto's. He pulled out two tiny rocks, discarded the debris. A strand of seaweed stuck to his pants. Those look filthy, I whispered. They're a secret, he said, quite a leap of faith. His voice was quiet with the motor of the fridge, and I involuntarily shivered. He pulled a blunt knife out of his pocket and wedged the tip into an invisible crack. Two switches of his wrist, and it was open. Where'd you learn to do that? He pinched a lemon over it and said, take it quickly. I flipped the shell back. I was prepared for the brininess, for the softness of it, for the rigidity and strangeness of the ritual, adrenalized, fiercely private. I opened my eyes. Jake was looking at me and said, they're perfect. He handed me the beer. It was nearly black, persuasive as chocolate, weighty. The finish was cream. It matched the oyster's creaminess. The sensory conspiracy made the blood rush to my head. Ignore him. That's what I told myself. Look away. I looked at him. Can I have another? Thank you.
We'll be right back with Ruth Reichel and Chef Nancy Silverton. Do you have any fun baking projects planned for this weekend? Be sure to add Kerrygold Pure Irish Butter to your grocery list. Whether you're trying your hand at 4-20 Blackbird's famous pie crust recipe, Dory Greenspan's chocolatey world peace cookies, or Hot Bread Kitchen's garlic naan with green chili, you need quality butter to make these recipes the best they can be. Kerrygold's milk comes from grass-fed cows that graze up to 300 days, making it perfect for all your sweet and savory baking needs. You'll soon know why so many bakers and pastry chefs love Kerrygold butter.
Boys and girls are on fire. How did you two become friends?
So I know that Ruth was living in San Francisco. I believe you were writing for California or New West magazine?
They were the same. New West became California.
Okay, so the magazine that none of you out in this room, because I'm looking at how young everybody
really,
is, so you don't know.
Long gone.
But it was a magazine that featured both Southern and Northern California, right?
Right.
And she had just gotten the job as the food critic for the Los Angeles Times. And I got a call, and I don't remember from who, that said, Ruth Reichel is moving to town. She knows no one, and she has no friends. Can you be her friend? So I invited her over for dinner.
That's actually, and the truth is, I had been living in Berkeley, and I came here with the biggest Northern California chip on my shoulder. Yeah, I hate L.A. Why am I doing this? Stupid move. I'm going to hate everybody down there. And I will never forget that night, because the thing that the food was great, the company was great, but the thing that completely made me think, okay, it's not going to be so bad here, is you had a cat that was prancing across the kitchen counter, and I thought, okay, it'll be all right here.
It begs the question, why did you take the job if you were that down on L.A.?
They had been wooing me for a couple of years. I'd been a freelance writer. I was 35 years old. I'd never had a real job. I mean, I was so unaccustomed to having a real job that in my first year at the L.A. Times, I went in on the 4th of July and sort of looked around and said, where is everybody? I mean, freelance writers don't ever have a day off. And so it was appealing that, you know, I'd have health insurance.
Did you ever review one of Nancy's restaurants?
No. I mean, we became friends pretty quickly. And then we sort of had this group of ladies' dinners, and we went out at least once a month. And when they were opening Campanile and La Brea, we would sometimes come and spend the night with Nancy while she was, you know, testing breads. And I tried to write a review saying we're friends, and you can't do that. I mean, it's just, there's no way to do it.
What Ruth's trying to say is that she is a very ethical food writer or food critic. And I think that that's hard, because how can you expect a food critic to have no friends in the business, right? It's not really fair. So, I mean, whenever Jonathan Gold writes about any of my restaurants, it's like every time he says, in parentheses, by the way, she's a friend and my wife wrote one of her cookbooks. But every time he feels like, and I understand why, he has a need to do that. And so you never reviewed?
No, I never. I couldn't. I mean, and the hardest thing was that then I became, in addition to being the restaurant critic, the food editor. And as a food editor, you have to know chefs. And it was really a complicated dance. And so when I got to New York at the New York Times, it was like, I don't know any New York chefs, and I'm not going to get to know any of them. I'm going to really pull myself out of this world.
Did that work?
It did, but I really missed chefs, because one of the reasons I loved this world is, I mean, I think it's really hard to be a good chef if you have a mingy soul. I mean, there's a kind of generosity about food people, and I really missed it. Food people have a kind of openness and generosity that, there I was suddenly around journalists and, rich people who wanted to go out to eat, and it was a very different kind of people I got to know when I was at the Times.
Did you miss California?
I did a lot. I did a lot. I mean, I have come to think that L.A. is a great place to live and not a great place to visit. It's sort of the opposite of New York.
So you both have very deep ties to California. Nancy, you grew up here, and I love this fact about Nancy. Her mom was a writer for General Hospital. So did you know Luke and Laura personally?
You know what? I never, ever saw one episode of General Hospital. And you know what? I found out just before she died that it really hurt her feelings, that I never did. And so If okay. I had to do it over again, I would know who Luke and Laura were.
I might have watched enough to make up for that, because I think I ran home every day at 3 o'clock and turned on General Hospital. What was your California childhood like?
Well, I grew up in the San Fernando Valley. The San Fernando Valley is not the cool place to be, and I didn't know that. So I grew up there, and I remember when I was maybe 16, 17, something like that, where I started to take the bus to Santa Monica Beach. And one day I saw this wall that was graffitied, and it said, "Vals go home." And I'm like, "What's a Val?" So I was a Val. But I grew up in Los Angeles, and I lived in a very traditional slash very untraditional family in today's world, because I grew up in a family of four, mother, father, sister, brother. But what was so untraditional about it is that every single night at 6:30, we sat down and we ate dinner together at the table. And wow, for any of you that don't do that, I highly recommend it, because there is nothing more memorable as those meals sitting at the table. I learned about politics. I learned about the cases my dad won. He usually won, by the way. I learned about the stories my mom was writing. And it was a very long dinner, and I loved being at the table, but I really was not interested in the food whatsoever. So I did not grow up as so many young kids grow up today, where they are 7 years old and they're watching the TV Food Network and they want to be Mario Batali when they grow up, right? That I was not interested in the food world whatsoever.
So wait, when you said you were a Val, so you were one of the original like Valley girls?
I lived in the Valley. So like, what they were saying on the other side of the hill, which was the hip, cool place to be, is we don't want people from the San Fernando Valley.
Were those the Valley girls? Because I remember, everybody remembers Moon Unit Zappa's Valley Girl.
Yeah, but remember, I'm, by the way, 63 years old. So that was like before Moon Zappa. So yeah, she did do something on the Valley Girls. But that was pre-Moon Zappa.
And Ruth, you grew up in New York City, but wound up in Berkeley in the 1970s. Tell us about the Berkeley scene.
Oh, it was, you know, we were... So after graduate school, my husband and I moved to the Lower East Side of New York. I mean, New York in the early 70s was, we sort of lived the Patti Smith, that kind of life. I mean, half of our friends were living in, you know, illegal buildings, and it was grim on the Lower East Side of New York in the 70s. One day... my then husband is a site sculptor, and he just said, you know, I don't want to be here anymore. And we put everything we owned into our van and our cat, and we drove across to Berkeley because we had friends in Berkeley, and we camped in their backyard for a while. And then we all decided to get a house together, and it was like coming to paradise. I mean, first of all, I mean, we lived on nothing. I mean, for 10 years in that commune, our rent for me and Doug was $45 a month. The two of us lived on $3,000 a year for two of us. I mean, we never ate out, but we owned our life. We grew a lot of our own food in our backyard. It was the most wonderful time, and I feel really sad for kids today who don't get a chance to kind of not be in corporate life or have to make a lot of money. I mean, we decided we wanted time more than money, and he was an artist and I was a writer, and we would just, you know, take whatever jobs. I started a restaurant with some people. I mean, people say, oh, you're a chef. I mean, this was a modest little restaurant. We were a bunch of people who loved to cook, and just, it was kind of like, let's get together and open a restaurant. But it was possible then in Berkeley, and It was one of the more wonderful times. I mean, we literally, there were 10 of us. I mean, people would come and stay. You know, they'd move and say, can we stay at your house for a couple of nights and stay for 8 years? So it was like, we didn't have a lock on the door. There were always 15 or 20 people for dinner. It was fantastic. Everybody was making art and doing interesting things.
That means macrame. Right? I mean, really, Ruth was an original hippie. And still to this day, it's very hard to get rid of that hippie.
I never knew anyone who did macrame, although we did
I'm
have
I'm sure
some,
you did.
We did have some ferns hanging in macrame.
Well, what about God's eyes?
So did you have any idea that you were in what was going to become the epicenter of the food movement?
Well, we did. You know, I mean, the restaurant we started was started by people who were people who had worked at Chez Panisse. So, I mean, there was a real kind of sense about food. And there was also a real sense that food was political for us. I mean, you know, we stopped the war in Vietnam. We had a real sense of empowerment. So what's the next movement? And, you know, Frankie LePay's Diet for a Small Planet had come out, and it was kind of shocking when we suddenly saw that we were, you know, wasting 20 pounds of usable protein to get 1 pound of steak. And it was a real sort of wake-up call, and a lot of us started looking at the industrialization of American food. So food was very political, and we did think that we were going to have an impact. What we didn't know was that this focus on food, we would sort of like get interested in cooking, and it would take us away from the politics.
And you know, one of Ruth's, I'm just going to answer this for you. One of Ruth's roommates was S. Irene Verbilia, who everyone knows was the former food critic of the Los Angeles Times. So that must have been quite a household.
Of opinions. And Sherry happens to be a fantastic cook, one of the most intuitive cooks. So we ate very well.
So Nancy, you meanwhile went to Le Cordon Bleu in London and came back to work at Michael's in Santa Monica and at Spago with Wolfgang Puck. And I would imagine it was a bit flashier than what was going on in the commune in Berkeley.
Not flashy if you look behind the scenes in the kitchen. But I was living, I went to Sonoma State College. I did not finish. I'm a proud college dropout. In my senior year, I dropped out. But I sort of referenced earlier that I grew up in a family that we sat together and we loved to talk together, but we didn't necessarily eat together. Although my parents loved food, but I didn't like the food that they liked. My mother liked whole wheat bread, and I liked my bread. I liked white bread, and I liked processed food, and she would never hear of any of that in the house. But anyway, so I did not grow up with loving food.
Your mom needed Ruth in her life at that point.
And my mother, the worst part, you know, I was talking to my friend Margie, whose mother just passed away, and our mothers were very, very close, and they were very, very similar. And back in the 60s, growing up, although I was born in 1954, I talked about how humiliating it was for me to go to school with the school lunches that my mother packed me. So first of all, she was against any kind of non-reusable paper bag. So I was the only kid with a giant Ralph's bag that was cut off, that was this long, that I was rolled down and I carried. She also was very against plastic wrap and any kind of disposable thing. So everything was just thrown at the bottom of my bag. And nobody would share with me. And Margie's mother was very similar. And so I really did have a lot of food aversions. And I just wanted to eat and eat what everybody else at that time was eating. And it was convenient foods. That was the year of rice-a-roni and TV dinners and everything from a can or a box. And my mother was from scratch home cook.
Can I say, I will put my mother's lunches up against your mother's.
Yours were spoiled. Your mother's were spoiled. Mine weren't spoiled.
I mean, I would just take my mother's lunch and throw it in the garbage. I mean, nobody wanted anything in there. Rotten fruit.
But I started cooking in college, not for food. and I've talked about this in a couple of my books, but because I got into cooking for a boy, a cute boy. He had a beard, no mustache. I had never seen that before. He was a Buddhist. He had Birkenstocks. And so I went up to him. He was cooking in the college dorms. And I said, I really want to cook with you. I really want to cook in the college dorms. I love to cook. And he was a vegetarian cook for the dorms. And I said I was a vegetarian, which I wasn't. And he hired me. And I bought my first cookbook, which was called Cooking Creatively with Natural Foods. And I started cooking. And I loved it. And I made awful food, but it was there that I discovered that that's what I want to do for the rest of my life. So I was not a college graduate, and I started cooking in local restaurants, and I did end up going to the Cordon Bleu in London. I did end up working at Michael's restaurant in Santa Monica with Jonathan Waxman, and from there I went on to work for Wolfgang Puck. And lucky to say, and I know that you wanted to kind of talk a little bit about women in this field, and is it easy, and is it rough, and what did we experience? And I have to say that working for Michael / Jonathan and working for Wolfgang Puck, I didn't even realize that there was a gender issue.
Well, wait a minute. How could that be possible? Because I actually spent a year doing a piece about the opening of Michael's. It was before you were there.
And
he would not, I mean, Sally Clark, who is a great chef and had been with him in cooking school, and he wouldn't let her in the kitchen. He made her be the hostess.
See, I didn't know that. I knew that she was just a hostess. And now she has a fantastic restaurant. No, I didn't know that he wouldn't let her. All I know is that I work there, and I had no issues being... You know, I didn't come from a screaming, male-dominated French kitchen,
right,
which so many people
right.
of my generation did. So I've been very, very lucky.
Yeah, but, you know, that opening picture of Michael's...
Yeah, it was all men.
Where they look like rock stars. You know, they're all men. They're all under 25. They're all American, long hair, and not a woman in the group. And I don't think, other than Sally, I don't think he had any women on the floor either.
Were you the only woman in those kitchens?
You know what? I was. I didn't come in. They opened in early 1979, and I came a little bit later in 1979. So when I was there, I was the only woman. And then after myself, there was a young woman that started whose mother owned the cleaner two doors down.
And what was Spago like back then?
You know, Spago back then... Just because, you know, when Wolfgang, I don't know if everybody knows, Wolfgang started out in Los Angeles. I mean, he had much more experience before that. But he started out at Mommy's Own restaurant on Melrose in Los Angeles. And I don't know how many of you teenagers know what it was, but it was on Melrose. It's where I believe Inc. is now, if I'm not incorrect. And it was a restaurant that was where Hollywood ate. And Wolfgang was the Hollywood chef. So when he decided to open Spago, he had no plans on leaving Mommy's Own. He wanted to open a second restaurant on his own. He was going to hire my then husband, Mark, to be the chef. He thought there would be some nice sawdust on the floor, a little bit of red checkered tablecloths, and maybe someone playing music in the corner, and it was going to be an Italian restaurant, and that was his plans. And then he met Barbara Lazaroff, and that not only changed his world because he lost the sawdust. She said no to the red checkered cloth tables, but what she didn't know is that he, for whatever reason, left Mommy's Own, and he was going to run Spago. And he opened it up on a very, very low budget. There wasn't even a back kitchen for me to do any of my prep. There was only the front line because Barbara saw Wolfgang and his life and cooking as a stage. And she really was the first person that looked at restaurants that way, that thought that the chef belonged in the dining room because the chef was really the star. But he had no idea about the success of it, so much so that he said, "We open tomorrow. You think anyone will come?" And there were many things that he forgot about opening a restaurant. For instance, he forgot to hire anyone to answer the phones. So that was me, because the phone was right near where I worked. He forgot to hire a manager, and it went on and on and on down the line. And I think that he's probably still trying to catch up from those days and that success, because nobody expected what Spago became and how important it was a restaurant for Los Angeles and certainly for the country and the world, because it changed dining.
How so?
In the sense that dining could be casual. So it wasn't such a dichotomy between fast food and then fancy, but that people that were entertaining and people that were serious about food could actually have a great meal in a relaxed environment.
You can thank Barbara for the noisy restaurant.
Yeah,
Barbara. Her idea was don't make the seats too comfortable and turn up the decibels because it'll turn
and
the
lots
tables.
Of hard surfaces, right?
That wasn't David Chang who invented all that?
Oh, no, way,
you're
way
an East Coaster.
Before. Way before. One of the great things about Spago, I then ended up spending another year doing a piece about the opening of Chinois and spent so much time with Wolf and Barbara that, literally, Barbara would say, go get me some, I need some clean underwear. Go up in my drawer find me some underwear, which is a great tactic if you're a reporter to get them to just forget that you're writing everything down. But I remember going in the back at Spago and seeing Nancy working with baby Vanessa in a basket sitting on the counter next to her. Wolf was, his attitude was very different than almost any other chef I'd ever met, where he welcomed having the kid in the kitchen.
Remarkable.
So let's fast forward to the L.A. scene today. Why is L.A. so damn hot right now? Everybody, even in New York, is obsessed with Los Angeles.
Well, I think there are a few reasons. One is, we're all really interested in ethnic cooking, and the demographics of Los Angeles mean that it's really the only place in the country where, I once interviewed a Thai chef who said, I could spend my whole life never learning English because the Thai community is so big here, the Korean community. So the people who run restaurants in Little Tokyo or whatever, they don't need to appeal to anybody else but their own palates, which makes it a real hotbed for chefs who are looking for ideas. You don't have to travel. You just have to drive around L.A. and you kind of eat the world. One of the other things is I know a number of chefs in New York and Chicago who are coming to L.A. because the economics work better here. It's New York is getting really prohibitive. Anita Lowe.
New York
just,
and San Francisco.
And San Francisco. San Francisco probably worse. And Chicago is becoming that way too. So, this is, you've got a hungry city, you've got a really good critic, which also really has an impact. I think Jonathan drives a lot of the energy in restaurants here. A huge population of young people who, the real demographic for restaurants now is, people who are like 25 to 35, don't have kids yet, and have enough money to eat out. It's a perfect storm for restaurants here. And great produce. The products are fantastic.
All right, so you two both amaze me. You know that for one reason, one of the reasons is because you have no shortage of projects. So Nancy, you are starring in the next season of A Chef's Table on Netflix.
Which I'll probably never watch.
And it starts on February 17th, so mark your calendars. You can binge watch this weekend, right? So how was the filming? Fun, torturous, both?
It was grueling, and I didn't even know what Chef's Table was. And what was it? 2 years ago? When was Dominique's? 2 years ago. Okay. So 2 years ago, I got a call from a producer, introducing himself and asking if I would talk on behalf of Dominique Crenn in San Francisco on her episode of Chef's Table. And he had to explain to me what Chef's Table was. I was definitely apprehensive because it was something that I had just met at a food festival that Lucy Lean put on 3 years ago, and we had just done a lunch together. I had never met her before, and again, this was 3 years ago, and we hung out, and she was a very, just a very, very high-spirited, very, very talented chef, but I had never even been to her restaurant before. And they said, oh, that's okay. She really wants you to speak on her behalf. So I flew up there, and I spoke about her. It was after that, when I came back, that I got a call that they would like to do one on me. And so I thought, well, I better watch what this show is. And so I watched a couple of them, and, you know, they are shot beautifully, and they're orchestrated, and they, you know, are put to music. And they do really a great job. But I thought, and I still think, and that's why I probably won't watch it, is like, well, what is my story? Because the ones I watched Francis Melman. Did anyone see that one? Where he's like has an island, which I don't have, you know. You know, and then I watched, Dan Barber, who has a farm, you know, and Dan Barber is one of the great speakers, and he's so smart. And I'm watching these episodes, and it's like, I can't do that. And then, you know, I thought about it, and I thought about that I have a business, and one of my jobs is to create more business for my business. And then I thought about the staff that kept saying, please, we want you to do it, we want you to do it. And so I said yes, and then the shooting began. And so what they require is 10 hours of your time. Sorry, 10 days, 10 hours a day. And they also let you know that if they can get 7 minutes of those 10 hours a day that are filmable moments, then they feel successful. So all of it, I mean, it was really difficult, and it was so difficult just being on camera for 10 hours for 10 days. And they came to me, I have a little house in Italy. I don't have an island, but I do have a little house in Italy, and they decided they wanted to shoot there. And by the way, two things I have to say, just when you watch it and you see, like, why is she doing that? They did tell me afterwards, I was the only one that's been on the show so far that actually cooked. I mean, they had me do two meals, one at my house in L.A. and one in Italy, and I was the only one that didn't do, like, plated food. And that's the thing. It's like, what am I going to do? I mean, you saw, if you've seen the shows, they're all so intricate, and I'm so
It's a lot of tweezer action.
No, yeah. I'm like, I mix with my hands, and I plate with my hands, and there's, you know. But everything went really well until the last day, where they asked, they needed to have a certain amount of, they needed the last interview, and they needed a certain amount of shooting, and then they needed me to throw together a meal that should take like an hour and a half of time they gave me, but we ran late, and I really only had 45 minutes to do, and I'm trying to gather all this food together, and it was all about different cheeses that I used the first time that I cooked for Jeremiah Towers, who inspired me to open what became Mozza. Anyway, long story short, I had bags of freshly bagged mozzarella in water all over my counter, and they're filming, and I know they want to make you look good, but they're, you know, there, and they tell you to turn here, and you look up, and it was like, and then they said, no, don't put the bags there. They put them there, and then, like, all the bags fell on the floor. And that's when I was just about to cry.
Did you cry?
I didn't cry, but I said, I almost said I quit. But I said other expletives, because we're on the radio. I can't say what I said. I was done at that point.
Well, you know,
so when you see the mozzarella. think of it. I mean, I've never heard that sound until my water broke with my first child. It was just, it really, really was a splash.
Dan's description of what it was like to have them there was, they peeled me like an onion.
Yeah, it's hard. It's tough.
So, Ruth, you're no stranger to television. That's the whole reason you spend all this time in Los Angeles now, right? Because, Ruth, you're not based in L.A., but you do kind of winter here now. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, we spend a couple months here. It started with Top Chef Masters because they always filmed in February, and then we would move into Nancy's house when we were done filming and stay there for another month. We got to, there are right now, there's like 2 feet of snow at my house in upstate New York at the moment. I'm very happy to be here.
So, Ruth, this is great news for your fans. We have your show on Friday. And then for Ruth's fans, she is turning in her next memoir on Friday. Yay.
And, it may come back to me for another draft, but it's feels good to have it actually a beginning, a middle, and an end to this book.
What can you tell us about the book?
It's the gourmet memoir. And, it's actually been the hardest book that I've written because, each of my books, Tender at the Bone is about a little girl, which is charming, and I had my crazy mother to write about. And Comfort Me with Apples is really about, leaving one marriage and having another and the quest for having a child and this sort of magical moment of having one. And Garlic and Sapphires has all the disguises, which is fun to read about. And this one is, there's no romance in it. So it was really hard to figure out, what is the arc of this story? And the arc is really Condé Nast. The Condé Nast that I went into was a magic land. And that kind of publishing is gone forever. And it's not just the glitz and the glamour, which there certainly was. I had a clothing allowance and hair and makeup and a driver and all of that. But the thing that was really extraordinary was that Cy Newhouse was the last publisher in America who believed in quality, and that if you hired the best writers and the best art directors and really tried to give people a publication that mattered, that they would buy it. And they left me alone. I said, I'm going to come in here and I don't want to just write about recipes and restaurants and how to have lovely vacations. I think, food is a really important subject and we should be leading the conversation. There's so much to write about. And my publishers weren't always really happy about that. But we had an amazing run, and then everything changed in that company. So it's really about having real... the strangest three people running that company for the longest time, all fantastic characters. Steve Florio, there'll never be another head of any publishing company like him or an editorial director like James Truman. And then we got the Bean Counters. And so it's a kind of story of how that changed. But the joy of, being surrounded by really creative people and the staff. The staff I took over were people who were passionate about food, incredibly knowledgeable, all great characters. So that's the story, is this sort of magic moment that it just makes me so sad because it's gone forever.
Do you know when the book will be out?
At a guess, I would say about a year from now.
I can't wait. I know everyone else in the room feels the same way. Stephanie and I were talking earlier about how we still have a lot of our Ruth Reichel era gourmet magazines. And if I had a bigger apartment, I would probably have even more of them. So it's you don't want to part with them. I mean, it was a beautiful magazine.
I look at them, and I was so lucky. I had like the world's greatest art director, who's now doing beauty.
He is. Ruth, earlier when you were talking about the commune in Berkeley, you said food was political back then. And it's so interesting because I was listening to Anthony Bourdain on the New Yorker Radio Hour this weekend, and he said exactly that, food is political. And, you know, we haven't come full circle. I don't know what kind of circle we've come now, but I was looking at your Twitter account earlier because I was curious if you were even tweeting anymore, given what's going on, and I was happy to see, yes, you are still tweeting. Do you still like Twitter, even though it's been hijacked by the dark forces?
Well, but it's also, the people I follow on Twitter, I'm finding myself retweeting almost more than I'm tweeting now, because I find out all the really important political information, I find it first on Twitter. I mean, it's before it's on the New York Times site or any other site. I mean, there it is on Twitter. And I think it's a great tool. I had a really hard time. You know, my tweets are kind of airy. I believe that it's important to find moments of grace every day. And I really believe that, you know, you have to focus on the small pleasures of life, and that's how you get through it. But it did, you know, I mean, here's this stuff about people being deported in six counties in California, and, just the news is so horrible. It feels terrible to be saying, oh, I'm drinking the most wonderful cup of coffee and feeling the sun on my face. And I stopped tweeting, and I started getting people tweeting at me, please, you know, you give me a moment of hope every morning. So I started tweeting again, and I do think it's important. I mean, we have to resist, but we also have to try and keep our spirits up.
Nancy, I know you were marching.
I marched, but I didn't tweet. Or I haven't tweeted. I've never tweeted.
Is that a word?
Yeah, so, I don't. But I did march.
Mm-hmm. How was the L.A. march?
I was in the Washington march.
Oh, you were in D.C.? Yes. Oh, we missed you. Okay.
Were you there?
I was in D.C.,
What did
yes.
your sign say?
I had our T-shirts. I had our "Don't touch my pussy" or the White House Kitchen Garden T-shirt on.
Whoa! So I didn't see that one.
We can send you one.
I would like one. Well,
you can
I
wear
marched
it with pride.
For my two great aunts. So I had a picture of both of them laminated. They were sisters. It was my mother's aunts. So I marched for my Aunt Mary, who was a suffragist, and she was jailed, she tied herself to the White House. She was jailed for 10 days. She was a spokeswoman, and for her, we have many privileges that we didn't before. And then her sister, Evelyn, was a lobbyist in Washington, and she actually received the Medal of Freedom from Clinton, so I had a great picture of Hillary and her together. So I marched for them, so it was very important that I went to Washington. But there was a great march in L.A., too, I know.
How many of you were at the march?
Yay!
That's great. All right, so we are... I don't know how you improve being chained to the White House, but let's end on another optimistic note. Despite these uncertain times, we were talking about this earlier, things really seem to have changed for women in food, in the food space, in a really good way. And just quickly, what's your take on things today?
Well, I mean, I think that one of the great things is that as the food culture has expanded, and people used to think that you had to be a chef, and now there are so many ways to be in food, and there's so many activist positions, and so the choice that people of my generation felt, which was, you know, I want to be a chef, but I also want to be a mother, and it's too hard. Now, there are 1,000 other things you can do in the food space, and I think women are really coming into their own.
And so many of the women in this room represent that, whether right. it's Ellen or Stephanie or Renee or so many of you. Nancy?
Well, you know, I mean, it's a question that I get asked all the time about, you know, finally we've come to an era where women, you find women in the kitchen. And I do want to say that in my generation, there were a lot of fantastic women. So we were there before. I was with Ann Rosenzweig, and I was with Alice Waters and Judy Rogers and Barbara Tropp and Nancy Oakes and Jody Adams and Mary Sue Milliken and Susan, you know, Feniger. I could go on and on and on. So there were a lot of great women of my times and a lot of great women for that I really, really looked up to. And they're great women today.
That's it for today's show. Special thanks to our engineer, Dave Tatasciore, and the entire team at Heritage Radio Network, the home of Radio Cherry Bomb. Much love to Kerry Gold for making this season of Radio Cherry Bomb possible. Kerry Gold butter is made in Ireland with milk from grass-fed cows. It's a taste that says a thousand words. And thanks to our listeners. We wouldn't have reached our 100th episode if it weren't for you. We appreciate each and every one of you. You are the bomb.